Have that report on my desk by morning. And then she pulled out of the parking lot, turned quickly out onto the street. I didn't get into the Beetle. Instead, I watched the car that had followed us into the parking lot. It cruised around the far left side of the lot, then started down the row toward me and kept going. The driver, a striking woman with shaggy, dark brown hair peppered with gray, did not turn to look at me as she went past. I watched the car go, frowning. It left the lot, turning the opposite way Murphy had, and vanished from sight. Had that been the same vehicle that followed us down the JFK? Or had it only been my imagination? My gut told me that that woman in the car had been following me. But then again, my instincts had cried wolf before. I got into the Blue Beetle and thought for a minute. I was feeling guilty and a little queasy still. It was my fault Murphy had gotten into trouble. I had put her in the middle of extremely questionable circumstances by not telling her what was going on last spring. The pressure she was under now was my responsibility. I have what might be considered a very out-of-date and chauvinist attitude about women. I like to treat women like ladies. I like to open doors for them, pay for a meal when I'm on a date, bring flowers, draw out their seat for them, all that sort of thing. I guess I could call it an attitude of chivalry if I thought more of myself. Whatever you call it, Murphy was a lady in distress. And since I had put her there, it seemed only right that I should get her out of trouble, too. That wasn't the only reason I wanted to stop the killings. Seeing Spike torn up like that, it scared the hell out of me. I was still shaking a little, a pure and primitive reaction to a very primal fear. I did not want to get eaten by an animal, chewed up by something with a lot of sharp teeth. The very thought of that made me curl up on my car seat and hug my knees to my chest. An awkward position, considering my height and the comparatively cramped confines of the Beetle. What happened to Spike was as brutal and violent a death as anyone could possibly have. Maybe the thug deserved it. Maybe not. Either way, he was only one victim of many that had been torn apart by something that regular people shouldn't have to face. I couldn't just stand aside and do nothing. I'm a wizard. That means I have power. And power and responsibility go hand in hand. I have a responsibility to use the power I've been given, and there is a need for it. The FBI was not in any sense prepared to deal with a pack of ravening werewolves stalking down victims in the midst of the Chicago autumn. That was more my department. I let out a long breath and sat up again. I reached into my duster's pocket for car keys and found the shard of glass wrapped up in my white handkerchief. I unwrapped it slowly and found the blood-smeared glass still there. Blood has kind of a power. I could use blood, cast a spell that would let me follow the blood back to the person who had spilled it. I could find the killer tonight, simply let my magic lead me to him, or them, but it would have to be now. The blood was almost dry, and once it was, I would have a hell of a lot more trouble using it. Murphy would be royally pissed if I took off without her. She would probably assume that I had intended to follow the trail tonight, purposely leave her out of the loop. But if I didn't follow the trail, I'd lose the chance to stop the killer before the night fell. It didn't take me long to make up my mind. In the end, saving lives was more important than keeping Murphy from being pissed off at me. So I got out of the Beetle and opened the storage trunk at the front of the VW. I took out a few wizardly implements, my blasting rod, the replacement for my shield bracelet, and one thing that no wizard should be without, a Smith & Wesson 38 Chief Special. I carried all of these back to the front of the car with me and got out the shard of glass and smeared blood. Then I made with the magic. Chapter 5. I got out the lump of chalk I always keep in my duster's pocket, and the circular plastic dome compass that rides a strip of Velcro on my dashboard, then squatted down, my voluminous coat spreading out over my legs and ankles. I drew a rough circle on the asphalt around me with the chalk. The markings were bright against the dark surface and almost glowed beneath the light of the nearly full moon. I added an effort of will, a tiny investment of energy, to close the circle, and immediately felt the ambient magic in the air around me crowd inward, trapped within the confines of the design. The hairs at the nape of my neck prickled and stood on end. I shivered and took the shard of glass with its swiftly drying bloodstain and laid it down in a circle between the toes of my boots. I began a low little chant of nonsense syllables, relaxing, focusing my mind on the effect I wanted. Interessari, interessarium, I murmured, and touched the plastic dome of the compass to the damp blood. Energy rushed out of me, swirled within the focusing confines of the circle I had drawn, and then rushed downward into the compass with a visible shimmer of silver, dust-like motes. The compass needle shuddered, spun wildly, and then swung to the bloodstain on the dome like a hound picking up a scent. Then it whirled about and pointed to the southeast, whipping around the circle to hover steadily in that direction. I grinned in anticipation and smudged the chalk with my boot, releasing the remaining stray energy back into the air, and took up the compass and returned it to the blue beetle. The problem with this particular spell was that the compass needle would point unerringly at whoever the blood had come from until the sun rose the next morning and disrupted the simple magical energies I had used to make the spell. But it didn't point out the swiftest way to get to the target, only the direct direction in which he, she, or it lay. Traffic in Chicago isn't ever what any sane person would call friendly or simple. But I had lived there for a while and learned to survive. I drove past Cook County Hospital, a virtual city of its own inside Chicago, down past Douglas Park, and then turned south to Kedzie. The compass needle slowly aligned to point hard to the east, and I traveled south, and I wound up turning east on 55th, toward the University of Chicago in Lake Michigan. It wasn't exactly a good part of town. In fact, as far as neighborhoods go in Chicago, it was pretty bad. There was a high crime rate, and a lot of buildings were run down, abandoned, or infrequently used. Street lights were out in a lot of places, so when night closed in, it was darker than most areas. It's always been the favorite haunt for some of the darker things that come crawling out of the never-never for a night on the town. Trolls lurked about like muggers some nights, and any new vampire that came through the city always ended up in this neighborhood, or one like it, searching for prey until he could make contact with Bianca or one of the lesser vampire figures of the city. I pulled over as the compass swung to point at what looked like an abandoned department store, and I killed the engine. The faithful beetle rattled to a grateful halt. I got the map of the city out of the glove box and squinted at it for a moment. Washington Park and Burnham Park, where four of last month's deaths had been taking place, were less than a mile away on either side of me. I felt a little shiver run through me. It sure as hell looked like the place to find Murphy's Lobo killer. I got out of the car. I kept the blasting rod in my right hand, the dashboard compass in my left. My shield bracelet dangled from my wrist. My gun was in the left pocket of my duster, within easy reach. I took a moment to take a deep breath, to clear my mind, and to clarify what I wanted to do. I wasn't there to bring the killer down, whoever he was. I was just locating him for Murphy. Murphy could put the guy under surveillance and nail him the next time he tried to move. Even if I did capture him, Murphy couldn't exactly bring him up on charges, based on the word of a professional wizard. Municipal judges would love having a cop appear before them and start spouting crazy talk like that. I spun my blasting rod around in my fingers, grinned, and started forward. That was all right. I didn't need the justice system to recognize my power to be able to use it. There were boards over the front windows of the once department store. I tested each one as I went past and found that one swung in easily. I stopped and examined it carefully, wary of any alarms that might be attached to it, such as the string tied across the bottom, lined with little jingle bells. If I had pushed the wooden sheath any further inward, I would have set it to jangling. Instead, I slipped the string off the head of one of the nails that hung by, lowered the bells carefully, and slipped inside the dim confines of the abandoned store. It was a skeletal place. There were still the bones of shelves forming long aisles, but now barren of merchandise. Empty fluorescent light fixtures dangled in forlorn rows from the ceiling, and the powdered glass of shattered tubular bulbs dusted the floor beneath them. Light seeped in from the street, mostly moonlight, but more light came in from the back of the store. I checked my blood-stained compass. The needle was pointing firmly toward the light. I closed my eyes and listened. A skill that isn't hard to pick up, but that most people don't know how to do anymore. I heard voices, at least a pair of them, talking in hushed, urgent tones. I crept toward the back of the store, using the barren shelves to keep myself from being seen. Then I held my breath and peeked up over the top of the last row of shelves. Gathering around an old Coleman lantern were several people, all young, of various shapes and sizes and both genders. They were dressed in all shades of black, and most wore jackets and bracelets and collars of dark leather. Some had earrings, nose rings. One had a tattoo showing on his throat. If they had been tall, muscular folk, they would have looked intimidating, but they weren't. They were like college students, or younger, still some with acne or too oily hair, beards that wouldn't grow all the way in, and the thinness of youth. They looked awkward and out of place. Four or five of them were gathered behind and around a stout young man less than 5.5 feet tall. He had thick glasses and pudgy fingers, and would have looked more at home with a pocket protector than with the spiked leather gloves on his fingers. He stood with his hands on his hips, glaring up at the rail-thin blonde girl, at least a head taller than he was, the lines of her willowy body all awkward, her long, sad face set in an expression of anger. Her hair fell about her face and head in a ragged mane, but her eyes sparkled with contained wrath. Another 5 or 6 of the young people were gathered behind her, and everyone seemed tense. "And I'm telling you," the young man snarled in a muted voice, "that we should be out there right now. We can't allow ourselves to rest until we've found them all and torn them apart." There was a murmur of agreement from the people beside him. "I swear, Billy," the blonde said, "you are such a testosterone-laden idiot. If we were out there right now, they might catch on to us." "Use your head, Georgia," Billy snapped back. "You think they haven't figured it out by now? They could take all of us out right this minute if they hit us." "They haven't," Georgia pointed out. "She told us not to move again tonight, and I'm not moving. And if you try it, so help me, I'm going to tie your ankles to your ears." Billy growled, actually growled, though it sounded posed and forced, and stepped forward. "You think you can handle me, bitch?" he said. "Bring it on." George's eyes narrowed. "I didn't sign on to this wolf thing to fight hapless losers like you, Billy. Don't make me start now." She glared at the young people standing behind Billy. "You know what she told us. Are you going to start going up against her word?" "Listen, alphas," Billy said, turning to look at those behind him and then at those backing his opponent. "I've led you for all this time. I've done what I've promised to do. Are you going to stop trusting me?" I peered at the discussion and then lowered my head again, back into the shadows. Holy, I was a teenage werewolf Batman. I checked my compass and it pointed firmly at the lit room, the group gathered around the lantern. Were these the killers? They looked more like a group of computer nerds geared up for leather night. Well, this was a start, at least. I could clear out now and let Murphy know what I'd seen. I need to check around the building outside first, see if any of the group had any cars parked nearby, to be able to give Murphy the license plate numbers. Hell, we weren't far from the university. Maybe some of them would have parking passes.
"What is the meaning of this?"
came a clear, strident woman's voice. I craned my neck up to the edge of the shelf again. A dark-complected woman, as tall as the long-faced blonde, but older, solid, with muscle, and moving with an animal surety, had come into the room from a back door. Her brown hair was peppered gray, and it took me only a second to recognize the woman from the car in the parking lot outside of McAnally's. My heart started to pound a little more quickly with excitement. She had been following Murphy and me after all. She glared at the two groups of young people, her eyes almost an eerie shade of amber that could barely be construed as brown. "Have I taught you no better?" the woman demanded. Billy and Georgia were looking down at the floor uncomfortably. The other young people had assumed similar postures, like a group of children caught planning to go out after curfew. "This isn't a game. Someone followed me here. They're on to us. If you start making mistakes now, you'll pay for them with your life," the woman said, stalking back and forth around the group. I checked my compass. The needle swung back and forth as she walked, pointing solidly at her. My heart leapt into my throat. I considered this woman with her almost animal vitality, her commanding presence and force of will. This woman, I thought, might be a killer. And she knew she had been followed. How? How in the hell had she known I was after her? I looked up at her again, excited, only to find her staring intently at the thick patch of shadows around the shelves I hid behind. One of the young people started to say something, and the woman raised her hand for silence. I saw her nostrils flare as she breathed in through her nose, and she took a step in my direction. I held my breath, not daring to duck back down behind the shelves, lest the motion give me away. "Join hands," snapped the woman. "Now." And she turned to the Coleman lantern on the floor and snuffed it out, plunging the room into blackness. There was a moment of confused murmuring, a commanding hiss from the woman, and then there was nothing but silence, and the sounds of shoes and boots moving over the tiles toward the back of the store. They were getting away. I rose, blind, and headed around the shelves toward them as quickly as I could, trying to follow. In retrospect, it wasn't my smartest decision, but I knew that I couldn't afford to let them get away. The spell I'd wrought on my compass wouldn't last long, not long enough to find the woman again, much less any of her pack of young people. I wanted to follow them out, to get the license plates on their cars, anything that would let me help Murphy locate them after they'd run. I miscalculated the length of my stride and bounced into the wall at the end of the aisle. I sucked in a hiss of pain and reoriented myself, following them, using the darkness to conceal me as much as they did. I could have made some light for myself, but as long as no one could see, no one would start shooting, either, I reasoned. I moved out carefully, listening and following the sounds. I had only a second's warning. The sound of claws sliding on the old tile, and then something large and furry slammed into my legs below the knee, taking them out from under me and sending me heavily to the floor. I let out a shout and swung my blasting rod like a baseball bat, feeling it crack down solidly on something hard and bony. There was a snarl, a deep animal sound, and something tore the rod from my hand and sent it flying away. It clattered hollowly on the tile floor. I dropped my compass, scrambled for my gun, and got my feet underneath me, backpedaling, yelling my fear out in a wordless challenge. I stood still for a moment, staring at nothing, breathing hard, my gun heavy in my hand. Fear made my heart pound, and as always, anger followed hard on the heels of fear. I was furious that I had been attacked. I'd half expected something to try to stop me. But in the dark, whatever had been snarling had scared me a lot more than I'd thought it would. Nothing happened for a minute, and I couldn't hear anything. I reached into my shirt and drew out the silver pinnacle that had been my mother's, the five-pointed star upright within the circle, the symbol of order, symmetry, balance of power. I focused my will on it, concentrating, and the pinnacle began to glow with a faint, gentle light. Hardly the binding luminescence that came as a result of focusing power against a being of the never-never, but adequate enough to navigate by, at least. I moved toward the back room. Blue-white light like moonlight pooled around me. It was definitely stupid to keep moving forward. But I was angry, furious enough to bumble my way through the back room of the department store until I saw the blue outline of an open doorway. I headed for it, tripping over a few more things along the way that I couldn't quite make out in the wear light of my amulet, angrily kicking a few things from the path of my feet until I emerged into an alleyway behind the old building, breathing open air, able to see again the dim shapes and colors. Something hit me heavily from behind, driving me to the ground, gravel digging into my ribs through my shirt. My concentration vanished, and with it the light of my amulet. I felt something hard and metallic shoved against the back of my skull, a knee pressed into the small of my back, and a woman's voice snarled, "Drop the gun, or I'll blow your head off." Chapter 6. Call me crazy, but I'm not big on defiance when I've got a gun rammed against my skull. I carefully set the .38 in my left hand down and moved my fingers away from it. "Hands behind your back. Do it," snarled the woman. I did it. I felt the cold metal of the handcuffs around my wrists, heard the ratcheting sound of the cuffs closing around them. The knee lifted off my back, and my attacker shoved me over with one leg, snapped on a flashlight, and shone it in my eyes. "Harry?" she said. I blinked and squinted against the light. I recognized the voice now. "Hi, Murphy. This is going to be one of those conversations, isn't it?" "You jerk," Murphy said, her voice harsh. She was still only a shadow behind the flashlight, but I recognized the contours now. "You found a lead and followed it, and you didn't contact me." "Those who live in glass houses, Lieutenant," I said, and sat up, my hands still tightly behind my back. "There wasn't time. It was hot, and I couldn't afford to wait, or I might have lost it." Murphy grunted. "How did you find this place?" "I'm a wizard," I told her, and wagged my arms as best I could. "Magic, what else?" Murphy growled, but hunkered down behind me and unlocked the cuffs. I rubbed at my wrists after they were freed. "How about you?" "I'm a cop," she said. "A car tailed us to McAnally's from the murder scene. I waited until it was gone and followed it back here." She stood up again. "You were inside. Did anyone go out the front?" "No, I don't think so. But I couldn't see." "Damn it," Murphy said. She put her gun away in her coat. "They didn't come out the back. There must be some way up to the roof." She stood up and peered around at the closely packed buildings, shining a flashlight around the roof's edge. "They're long gone by now." "Win some, lose some," I got to my feet. "Like hell," she said, and turned and started into the building. I hurried to catch up with her. "Where are you going?" "Inside, to look for the stairs, a ladder, whatever." "You can't follow them," I said, falling into step behind her as she went into the darkened building. "You can't take them on, not just you and me." "Them?" Murphy said. "I only saw one." She stopped and looked at me, and I explained to her in terse terms what had happened since we parted in the parking lot. Murphy listened, the lines at the corner of her blue eyes serious. "What do you think happened?" she asked when I finished. "We found werewolves," I said. "The woman, the dark one with the gray in her hair, was their leader." "Group killers?" Murphy said. "Pack," I corrected her. "But I'm not sure that they were the killers. They didn't seem, I don't know, cold enough, mean enough." Murphy shook her head and turned to walk outside. "Can you give me a good description?" I kept up with her. "Good enough, I guess. What do you want it for?" "I'm going to put out an APB for the woman we saw, and I want you to describe the kids you heard talking." "What do you need that for? Don't you have the plates off the car she was driving?" "I already called them in," Murphy said. "Rental, probably taken out under a false ID." "I think you've got the wrong people, Murph," I said. "Don't put out that APB." "Why shouldn't I?" Murphy asked. "Someone follows me back to town from the scene of a murder. Not only that, but you can confirm to me that they were the killer from the scene. Not in a court of law, I know, but you can give it to me. That's enough. Standard investigation will turn up the rest if we know where to look." I held up my hand. "Hold on. Hold on. My spell didn't tell me that the woman was the killer, only that it was her blood on the scene." Murphy folded her arms and glared at me. Whose side are you on, anyway? You still don't get it, Murphy, I said, my own temper rising a little. You don't start something with the kind of people who live in boogity land unless you're willing to take it all the way, right there, right then. If you start harassing a pack of werewolves, setting the police after them, you've just declared war. You'd better be ready to fight it. Murphy thrust her jaw out. Don't worry about me. I can handle it. I'm not saying you can't, I said. But whatever it was that tore apart Spike back at Marconi's club wasn't the same thing that was with me in the dark back there. I jerked my head to the main room of the department store. Oh, yeah? Murphy said. Why not? Because it could have killed me, and it didn't. You don't think you could have taken care of yourself against a wolf, Harry? In the dark, I said. Murphy, it's been nearly 100 years since the wolf went extinct in most of the United States. You've got no idea, not at all, of how dangerous they can be. A wolf can run faster than you can drive a car through most of Chicago. His jaws can snap your thigh bones in one jerk. A wolf can see the heat of your body in the complete dark and count the hairs on your head from 100 yards off by starlight. He can hear your heart beating 30 or 40 yards away. The wolf that was there in the dark with me could have killed me easily. It didn't. It disarmed me, even after I hit it and then left. That doesn't mean anything, Murphy said. But she folded her arms over her stomach and glanced at the shadows around us with a little shiver. Maybe the killer knows you. Maybe it didn't want to risk killing a wizard. Maybe, just maybe, the wolf did it to throw you off. Maybe it spared you just so you would react in this way, just to avoid suspicion. Maybe, I admitted. But I don't think so. The kids I saw, I shook my head. Don't put out the APB yet. Hold off on it until I can get you some more information. Look, you pay me to give you advice, to be your consultant on the supernatural. I'm your expert, right? Listen to me. Trust me. She stared up in my face, her expression intent, looking away quickly when her eyes met mine. Murphy had known me for a while. You don't go looking into wizards' eyes without a darn good reason. Wizards see too much. All right, she said finally. I'll hold off on it, but only until tomorrow morning, when I have that report. If you can't show me anything by then, I'm going ahead after the people we saw tonight. Her mouth quirked in a fierce little grin. I'd have a hell of a time explaining what I was doing out at the crime scene in Rosemont anyway. The grin vanished, leaving only ferocity. But you will have that information for me, Dresden, bright and early. Make no mistake, I will catch the killer before anyone else dies. I nodded to Murphy. In the morning, I said. You got it. Murphy's flashlight flickered and went out as the filament burst with an audible pop. Murphy sighed in the darkness. Nothing ever works right when you're here. Sometimes, Harry, she said, I really hate hanging out with you. Chapter 7. I entered my apartment, tossed my blasting rod, which I had recovered from the abandoned department store, into the corner next to my wizard's staff and my sword cane, and locked the door behind me. It was one of those steel frame doors, the anti-burglar kind. I bought it after a demon had come stomping into my apartment 6 months ago and wrecked my place. My apartment is the basement of a huge old rooming house that somehow managed to survive all the Chicago fires. It was made almost entirely of wood, and it creaks and groans when the wind blows, which is all the time in this city, and makes gentle, soothing music. It's a place with a history. The neighbors are quiet, and my rent is cheap, though less so than it was before the demon trashed my place. The apartment itself is devoid of electrical devices, for reasons that should be evident by now. There's a fireplace and a kitchenette off the main room, a little bedroom adjacent to that, and a bathroom inside of the bedroom. Sunken windows are high on each of the four walls, and one is on the wall of the bathroom. I decorate in textures more than I do in colors. There are thick rugs all over the bare stone floors, layered on top of one another in most places. Demon acid had burned away most of my furniture, and I had been obliged to scavenge second-hand stores for replacements. I like furniture with a lot of wood and soft cloth, and I'd made my purchases accordingly. Tapestries hung from my walls, the oldest tapestries that I could find, covering the bare stone. In the ruddy firelight, The oranges and browns and reds that constituted the primary colors of the decor didn't look half bad. I went over to the fireplace and built a fire. October in Chicago is a cold, breezy month, and my dank little haven is usually chilly until I get a fire going. I dropped a few logs on the fire, and Mister made an appearance, rubbing against my leg and purring fondly, staggering my balance off to one side. "Been getting into the steaks again, eh, Mister?" I said, and rubbed the big gray cat's ears. Mister's larger than most dogs. Maybe one of his parents was part wildcat. I found him in a dumpster one day when he was a kitten, and he promptly adopted me. Despite my struggles, Mister had been an understanding soul, and I eventually came to realize that I was part of his little family, and by his gracious consent, allowed to remain in his apartment. Cats. Go figure. I fired up the wood-burning stove and prepared a quick meal of SpaghettiOs, grilled chicken, and toast. Mister shared in my meal and split a can of Coke with me, as usual, and I tossed the dishes into the sink to soak before I went to my room and put on my robe. Let the wizardry commence. I went to the spot in the far corner and moved the rug there, then lifted up the door in the floor beneath it, revealing the steep stepladder that led down to the sub-basement where I kept my lab. I teetered down the stairs, holding a lit candle that cast a golden glow on the cheerful havoc that is my laboratory. Tables lined the walls, and the longest table filled most of the center of the room, leaving a cramped walk space around it, except for an area at the far side of the lab that I kept completely clear for my summoning circle, a ring of bright copper set into the floor. Books, notebooks, defunct ballpoint pens, broken pencils, boxes, plastic containers, old butter bowls, empty jelly jars, and plastic baggies lay next to other containers of every size and shape that held the spices, rare stones, bones, fur, blood, oddments, jewelry, and other ingredients useful to wizardly pursuits and studies. I reached the bottom of the ladder, stepped over a precariously balanced stack of comic books, don't ask, and started lighting the other candles that lay on dishes around the chilly room, finally bending to light up the kerosene heater that I keep down in the lab in an effort to at least blunt the cold. "Bob," I said then, "wake up, sleepyhead." Up on one of the shelves, huddled in the midst of the thick stack of hardbacks, was the bleached, smoothed form of a human skull, its empty eye sockets gaping. Deep in those eye sockets, there was a flickering of orange light, which grew and solidified into twin points of lambent illumination.
"Sleepyhead? Oh, that's rich, Harry. With a sense of humor like that, you could make a living as a garbage man anywhere in the country."
The skull's mouth gaped open in a parody of a yawn, though I knew the spirit within, Bob, didn't feel fatigue in the same way that living beings did. I put up with his lip, so to speak. Bob had worked for several wizards over the course of a dozen mortal lifetimes, and he knew more about the nuts and bolts of magic than I ever would.
"What are we doing now?" Bob sniggered. "More weight loss potions?"
"Look, Bob," I said, "that was only to get me through the rough month. Someone's got to pay rent around here."
"All right," Bob said smugly. "You going to get into breast enhancement, then? I'm telling you, that's where the money is."
"That isn't what magic is for, Bob. How petty can you get?"
"Ah," Bob said, his eye lights flickering. "The question is, how pretty can you make them? You aren't a half-bad wizard, Dresden. You should think about how grateful all those beautiful women will be."
I snorted and started cleaning off a space at the center table, stacking things up to one side.
"You know, Bob, some of us aren't obsessed with sex."
Bob snorted. No easy feat for a guy with no nose or lips.
"Some of us don't take a real working body and all five senses for granted either, Harry. When's the last time you saw Susan?"
"I don't know," I responded. "Couple weeks ago. We're both pretty busy with work." Bob heaved a sigh.
"A gorgeous woman like that, and here you are, down in your musty old lab, getting ready to do more ridiculous nonsense."
"Precisely," I said. "Now shut up, and let's go to work." Bob grumbled something in Latin, but rattled a few times to shake the dust off the skull.
"Sure, what do I know? I'm just a pathetic little spirit, right?"
"With a photographic memory, 300 or 400 years worth of research experience, and more deduction capacity than a computer, Bob. Yeah."
Bob almost seemed to smile. "Huh, just for that,
You get my best effort tonight, Harry. Maybe you're not such an idiot after all. Great, I said. I want to work up a couple of potions, and I want to know everything you know about werewolves. What kind of potions and what kind of werewolves? Bob said promptly. I blinked. There's more than one? Hell, Harry. We've made at least 3 dozen kinds of potions down here ourselves. I don't see why you wouldn't... No, I growled at Bob. Werewolves. There's more than one kind of werewolf? More than one kind of what? Bob tilted his skull over to one side, as though cocking an invisible hand to his ear bones. Werewolf, werewolf.
Werewolf, Bob replied solemnly, his voice seething with hokey accent. Their castle.
I blinked at Bob. Huh? What the heck are you talking about?
It's a joke, Harry. Stars almighty, you never get out, do you?
I eyed the grinning skull and growled in frustration. Don't make me come up there.
Okay, sheesh. Aren't we grumpy tonight? Bob's jaws stretched in a yawn again.
I'm working another murder case, Bob, and I don't have time to goof around.
Murder? Mortal business? So complicated. You never hear about murder charges in the Never Never.
That's because everything there is immortal. Bob, just shut up and tell me what you know about werewolves. If there's a bunch of different flavors, tell me what they are. I got out a notebook and a fresh pencil, then a couple of clean beakers with alcohol flame burners to heat whatever liquid I put in them.
All right, Bob said. How much do you know?
Exactly nothing about werewolves. My teacher never covered that with me. Bob barked out a harsh little laugh.
Old Justin had a lousy sense of just about everything. He got what was coming to him, Harry, and don't let anyone on the White Council tell you any different.
I stopped for a moment. A sudden rush of mixed feelings, anger and fear and mostly regret, washed through me. I closed my eyes. I could still see him, my teacher, dying in flames born of my will and anger. I don't want to talk about it.
Hell, the council even suspended the sentence on you. You were vindicated.
Say, I wonder whatever happened to Elaine.
Now, there's a sweet piece of
werewolves, Bob, I said in a very quiet, very angry voice. One hand started to hurt, and I saw that my fingers had clenched into a fist, the knuckles turning white. I turned my eyes to him, glaring. I heard the skull make a gulping sound, and then it said,
Right. Okay. Werewolves. And, which potions did you want?
I want a pick-me-up potion, a night's rest in a bottle, and I want something that will make me imperceptible to a werewolf. I reached out for the notebook and my pencil.
First one's tough to do. There's nothing quite like a decent night's sleep. But we can make some super coffee, no problem.
He spouted out a formula to me, and I noted it down as he went, my handwriting too dark and angular. I was still angry from the mere mention of my old master's name, and the welter of emotions that rushed up from my memories of Elaine wouldn't subside for an hour. We all have our demons.
What about the second one? Can't really be done, Bob said. Wolves have just got way too much on the ball to hide from every one of their senses without doing some major work. I'm talking like a greater ring of invisibility, not just a shadow cape or something.
Do I look like I'm made of money? I can't afford that. What about a partial hiding potion, then?
Oh, like a blending brew?
Look like an unobtrusive part of the background, something like that? I would think that would be most useful, really. Keep you from being noticed, to begin with.
Sure, I said. I'll take what I can get.
No problem, Bob assured me, and rattled off another formula, which I jotted down. I checked the ingredients list, and thought that I had them all stocked among the countless containers on my shelves.
Fine. I can get started on these. How much do you know about werewolves, Bob?
Plenty. I was in France during the Inquisition. Bob's voice was dry, but that was to be expected, considering. I started on the first potion, the stimulant. Every potion has 8 parts. 1 part is a base liquid to hold the others and provide a medium for mixing. 5 parts are symbolically linked to each of the 5 senses. 1 is similarly linked to the mind, and the other to the spirit. The basic ingredient to the stimulant potion was coffee,
while the base for the scent-masking potion was water. I got them both to boiling.
A lot of werewolfery going on, then?
Are you kidding? Bob said. It was Werewolf Central. We had every kind of werewolf you could think of. Hexen wolves, werewolves, lycanthropes, and loup garou to boot. Every kind of lupine theriomorph you could think of.
Therio-what?
I said.
Theriomorph, Bob said.
Anything that shapeshifts from being human into an animal form. Werewolves are theriomorphs. So are were-bears, were-tigers, were-buffaloes.
Buffaloes? I asked.
Well, sure. Some Native American shamans could do a buffalo. But almost everyone does predators. And until pretty recently, wolves were the scariest predator anyone around Europe could think of.
Okay, I said. And there's a difference between the types of werewolves.
Right, Bob confirmed. Mostly it depends on how you go from human form to wolf form, and how much of your humanity you retain. Don't burn the coffee.
I turned down the flame beneath a beaker of coffee, annoyed.
I know, I know. Okay, then. How do you get to be a wolf?
The classic werewolf, Bob said, is simply a human being who uses magic to shift himself into a wolf.
Magic? Like a wizard?
No, Bob said. Well, sort of. He's like a wizard, who only knows how to cast the one spell, the one to turn him into a wolf, and knows how to get back out of it again. Most people who learn to be werewolves aren't very good at it for a while, because they keep all of their own humanity.
What do you mean?
Well, Bob said, they can reshape themselves into the form of a wolf, but it's pretty much just topology. They rearrange their physical body, but their mind remains the same. They can think and reason, and their personality doesn't change. But they don't have a wolf's instincts or reflexes. They're used to being sight-oriented bipeds, not smell-oriented quadrupeds. They would have to learn everything from scratch.
Why would someone do something like that? I said. Just learn to turn into a wolf, I mean.
You've never been a peasant in medieval France, Harry, Bob said. Life was hard for those people. Never enough food, shelter, medicine. If you could give yourself a fur coat and the ability to go out and hunt your own meat, you would have jumped at the chance, too.
Okay, I think I got it, I said. Do you need silver bullets or anything? Do you turn into a werewolf if you get bitten?
Bah, Bob said. No,
Hollywood stole that from vampires. And the silver bullet thing is only in special cases. Werewolves are just like regular wolves. You can hurt them with weapons just like you can a real wolf.
Now that's good news, I said, stirring a potion. What other kinds are there?
There's a version of a werewolf when someone else uses magic to change you into a wolf. I glanced up at him.
Transmortification? That's illegal, Bob. It's one of the laws of magic. If you transform someone into an animal, it destroys their personality. You can't transform someone else without wiping out their mind. It's practically murder.
Yeah, neat, huh?
But actually, most personalities can survive the transformation. For a little while, at least. Really strong wills might manage to keep their human memories and personality locked away for several years. But sooner or later, they're irretrievably gone, and you're left with nothing but a wolf.
I turned from the potions to scribble on my notebook.
Okay. What else makes a werewolf?
The most common way, back in France, was to deal with a demon, or a devil, or a powerful sorcerer. If you got a wolf hide belt, put it on, say some magical words, and whammy, you're a wolf. A hexen wolf.
Isn't that just like the first kind?
No, not at all. You don't just use your own magic to become a wolf. You use someone else's.
I frowned. Isn't that the second kind, then?
Stop being obtuse, Bob chided me. It's different because you're employing a talisman. Sometimes it's a ring or amulet, but usually it's a belt. A talisman provides an anchor for a spirit of bestial rage. Nasty thing from the bad side of the never-never. That spirit wraps around a human personality to keep it from being destroyed.
A kind of insulation, I said.
Exactly. It leaves you with your own intellect and reason, but the spirit handles everything else.
I frowned. Sounds a little easy.
Oh, sure, Bob said. It's really easy. And when you use a talisman to turn into a wolf, you lose all of your human inhibitions and so on. And you just run on your unconscious desires, with a talisman spirit in charge of the way the body moves. It's really efficient. A huge wolf with a human-level intelligence and an animal-level ferocity. I eyed Bob and gathered up the other ingredients for the stimulant potion. A morning donut for taste, a cock's crow for hearing, fresh soap for smell, bits of a washcloth for touch, and a beam of dawn sunshine for sight. A to-do list for the mind, and a bit of bright, cheerful music for the spirit, and the potion was simmering along nicely. Bob said nothing while I added the ingredients, and when I was finished, I said, "Most people don't have the strength to contain a spirit like that, I think. It would influence their actions, maybe even control them, suppress their conscience."
"Yeah, so?"
"So it sounds more like you're creating a monster."
"It's effective," Bob said. "I don't know about the good or the evil of the thing. That's something that only you mortals worry about."
"What did you call this flavor again?"
"Hexenwolf," Bob said, with a strong Germanic accent.
"Spellwolf. The church declared war on anyone who chose to become a Hexenwolf and burned a large number of people at the stake."
"Silver bullets," I asked.
"Bitten and turned into a werewolf?"
"Would you get off this bitten and turned into a werewolf kick, Harry?" Bob said. "It doesn't work that way. Not ever. Or you'd have werewolves overrunning the entire planet in a couple of years."
"Fine, fine," I sighed. "What about the silver bullets?"
"Don't need them."
"All right," I said, and continued jotting information down to put together for Murphy in a report.
"Hexenwolf.
Got it. What else?"
"Lycanthropes," Bob said.
"Isn't that a psychological condition?"
"It might also be a psychological condition," Bob said, "but it was a reality first. A lycanthrope is a natural channel for a spirit of rage. A lycanthrope turns into a beast, but only inside his head. The spirit takes over. It affects the way he acts and thinks, makes him more aggressive, stronger. They also tend to be very resistant to pain or injury, sickness. They heal rapidly. All sorts of things. But they don't actually shapeshift into a wolf."
"Give the boy a kewpie," Bob said. "They're just people too, but they're awfully fierce. Ever hear of the Norse berserkers? Those guys were lycanthropes, I think. And they're born, not made."
I stirred the stimulant potion and made sure it was at an even simmer.
"And what was the last one? The loop what?"
"Loop guru," Bob said.
"Or that was the name Etienne the Enchancer used for them, before he got burned at the stake. The loop guru are the major monsters, Harry. Someone has cursed them to become a wolf-like demon, and usually at the full moon. That someone's got to be really powerful, too, like a major heavyweight sorcerer or a demon lord or one of the fairy queens. When the full moon comes, they transform into a monster, go on a killing spree, and slaughter everything they come across till the moon sets or the sun rises." A sudden chill went over me and I shivered.
"What else?"
"Supernatural speed and power, supernatural ferocity. They recover from injuries almost instantly if they become hurt at all. They're immune to poison and to any kind of sorcery that goes to the brain. Killing machines."
"Sounds great. I guess this hasn't happened all that often. I'd have heard something by now."
"Right," Bob said. "Not often. Usually the poor cursed bastard knows enough to shut himself away somewhere, or head out into the wilderness. So the last major loop guru rampage happened around Gévaudan, France, back in the 16th century. More than 200 people were killed in a little more than a year."
"Holy shit," I said. "How did they stop it?"
"They killed it," Bob said. "Here's where the silver bullets finally come in, Harry. Only a silver weapon can hurt a loop guru. And not only that, the silver has to be inherited from a family member. Inherited silver bullets."
"Really? Why would that work and not a regular silver?"
"I don't make the laws of magic, Harry. I just know what they are and have an idea when they're changing. That one hasn't changed. I think maybe it has something to do with the element of sacrifice."
"Inherited silver," I mumbled.
Well, we'll just have to hope that that wasn't a loop guru, I guess.
If it was a looper, you'd know, Bob said wisely. In the middle of this town, you'd have a dozen people dead every time the full moon came round. What's going on? A dozen people are dying every time the full moon comes around. I filled Bob in on the Lobo killings, giving him all the information Murphy had given to me, and started on the next potion. Into the water went the ingredients. Plastic wrap for sight, a bit of plain white cotton for a touch, a little deodorant for smell, a rustle of wind for hearing, a leaf of plain old lettuce for taste, and finally I threw in a piece of blank paper for the mind, and some elevator music for the spirit. The ingredients were boring. The potion looked and smelled boring. Perfect.
Lot of dead people, Bob commented. I'll let you know if I think of anything good. I wish I knew something else.
I want you to learn more, I told him. Go out and see what else you can round up on werewolves. Bob snorted.
Fat chance, Harry. I'm a spirit of intellect, not an errand boy.
But when I said the word out, Bob's eyes glittered.
I'll pick you up some new romance novels, Bob, I offered.
Bob's teeth clicked a couple of times thoughtfully.
Give me a 24-hour pass, he said.
I shook my head. Forget it. The last time I sent you out, you invaded a party over at Leola and set off an orgy. Bob sniffed.
I didn't do anything to anyone that a keg wouldn't have done.
But those people didn't ask for you to get into their systems, Bob. No way. You had your fun, and I'm not letting you out again for a while.
Oh, come on, Harry.
No, I said, flatly.
It would only be one little...
No, I said again. Bob glowered at me and demanded. New romances. None of those tatty used ones. I want something off the bestseller list. I want you back by sunrise, I countered.
Fine, Bob snapped. I can't believe how ungrateful you are. After everything I've done for you, I'll see if I can get someone's name.
There might be a spirit or two who could get you some juicy information. The orange lights that were his eyes glittered and then flowed out of the skull in a misty cloud of lambent illumination. The cloud flowed up the ladder and out of my laboratory. I sighed and set the second potion to simmering. It would take another hour or two to cook the potions and then to shove the magic into them. So I sat down with my notebook and started writing up my report.
I had to help Murphy nail the killer, whoever it was, while avoiding any trouble with the FBI. Otherwise, she was out of a job, and even if I didn't end up in jail, I would be out of a living myself. Johnny Marconi's man had been killed, and I'd be a fool to think he would stand idly by and do nothing in response. I was sure the gangster would rear his head sooner or later.
Aside from all that, there was a monster of one kind or another lurking in the dark, and the police and the FBI had been helpless to stop it. That left only me, Harry Dresden, your friendly neighborhood wizard, to step in and do something about it. And if the killer figured out that I was getting involved, he would doubtless start gunning for me next. My troubles were multiplying. Hexenwolves, werewolves, lycanthropes, loop guru. What did they think of next?
Chapter 8. The police headquarters downtown consists of a sprawling collection of buildings that have sprung up over the years as need for law enforcement has increased. They don't match, and they come from a wildly varying selection of styles and designs, but they have somehow adapted themselves into a cohesive whole, much like the force itself. Special Investigations operates out of a big, run-down old building, a huge cube that has managed to hold up solidly in spite of the years, the grime, the smog, and the graffiti sprayed on the walls. It has bars over the windows and the doors and sits hunkered amidst buildings much taller than it, like a faithful old bulldog amidst a crowd of unruly children struggling to maintain peace and order. The inside of the building is plain, even dingy, but they keep it clean. The old war horse of a desk sergeant eyed me as I entered the station, his gray mustache bristling over an impressive jaw. "Hiya, Bill," I told him, and held up the manila envelope I had under one arm. "Bring something to Murphy and S.I.
"Dresden," he said wearily, and jerked a thumb toward the stairs behind him, giving me permission to go by.
I hadn't got much sleep the night before, but I had showered and dressed nicely before I left the house, in neat business clothes for once, instead of my usual western shirt and blue jeans. I kept the battered old duster, though, with my blasting rod dangling from a thong inside of it. I took the stairs two at a time and passed a few cops along the way. Several recognized me, and one or two even nodded, but I thought I could detect a sense of uneasiness from each of them. Apparently, I was carrying a distinct odor with the law at the moment. I wrinkled up my nose. The police had always known me as something of a nut, the crazy guy who claimed to be a wizard, but a useful nut, who could provide good information, and whose apparent psychic abilities had helped them on a number of occasions. I was used to being seen as one of the good guys, but now the cops were giving me the neutral, professional glances that they would give to a potential criminal, rather than the casual greetings one would give to a comrade in arms. It was to be expected, maybe, since rumor had associated my name with Johnny Marconi, but it was still disturbing. I was muttering to myself, and deep in my own sleep-deprived thoughts, when I bumped into a tall, lovely woman, dark of hair and eye, full of mouth, long of leg. She was wearing a tan skirt and jacket with a crisp white blouse. Her raven brows furrowed in consternation until she looked up at me, then glowed with a sort of friendly avarice. "Harry," she said, her lips curving into a smile. She stood up on her tiptoes and kissed my cheek. "Fancy seeing you here." I cleared my throat. "Hi, Susan," I said. "Did that syndication deal go through?" She shook her head. "Not yet, but I'm hoping. After those stories you gave me last spring, people started taking me a little more seriously." She paused, drawing in a little breath. It made her chest rise and fall, most attractively. "You know, Harry, if you're working with the police again, and you should happen to be able to let me in on whatever is going on..." I shook my head and tried to scowl at her. "I thought we agreed. I won't poke into your business deals, and you won't poke into mine." She smiled up at me and touched a finger to my chest. "That was whenever we were out on a date, Harry." She let her eyes wander down the length of my body and then back up. "Or staying in on one." "Susan Rodriguez, I never knew you were a lawyer as well as a journalist." "Now you're getting nasty," she said, grinning. "Seriously, Harry, another exposé like last spring could make my career." "Yeah, well, after last spring, the city made me sign about 2 tons of non-disclosure agreements. I can't tell you anything about the case."
"So don't tell me about the case, Harry.
But if you could mention, say, a nice spot on the street where I might stand and get some good pictures, I would be very..." She leaned up and kissed my neck. "Very..." The kiss traveled to my earlobe. "Grateful." I swallowed and cleared my throat, then took a step back down the stairs, away from her. I closed my eyes for a second and listened to the thunder of my suddenly pounding heart. "I'm sorry. I can't do that."
"Oh, Harry, you're no fun."
She reached down and ran a hand over my hair, then smiled to let me know that there were no bad feelings.
"But let's get together soon, all right? Dinner?"
"Sure," I said. "Hey, what are you doing down here this early?" She tilted her head, considering me.
"Trade me?"
"I'll show you mine if you show me yours. Off the record, even." I snorted.
Susan, give me a break."
She let out a little sigh and shook her head.
"I'll call you about dinner, all right?"
She started down the stairs past me.
"All right," I said. "All right, I'm bringing a report on werewolves to Murphy."
"Werewolves?" she said, her eyes lighting.
"Is that who's behind the Lobo murders?"
I frowned. "No comment. I thought the FBI was keeping that under wraps."
"You can't kill 12 people and expect no one to notice," Susan said, her voice sly. "I keep track of the city morgues."
"God, you're so romantic. All right, your turn. Give."
"I was trying to talk to the investigator from the Department's Internal Affairs. Word is that they're putting the pressure on Murphy, trying to clear her out of special investigations."
I grimaced.
"Yeah, I heard that too."
"Why does that concern you and the arcane?"
"The most successful preternatural investigator the police department has gets strung out to dry. Even if people don't believe it, Murphy does a lot of good.
If Murphy gets fired, and I can show how the numbers of mysterious crimes and unexplained deaths go up after she leaves, maybe I can get people to listen to the papers like the Arcane, and to people like you. I shook my head. People don't want to.